The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now seated. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. They are Gage Van Horn and Associates versus Neil Tatum from Taylor County and the 11th Court of Appeals. Board of Adjustment of the City of San Antonio versus Steve Lindy and others from Bear County, the 4th Judicial District. And Texas Natural Resource Conservation Commission versus Sierra Club and Downwinders at Risk from Travis County and the 3rd Judicial District. Board has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present argument in each of these cases. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We are recording these arguments, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee from the court. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Gage Van Horn and Associates versus Tatum.
May it please the court, Mr. Tom Whiteside to present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Is the court?
Mr. Walls. This is a covenant not to compete case, which the courts have construed before. And the question, of course, here is simply, may the employee or the promisor, may they recover their attorney fees by filing a declaratory judgment action in the case? And it's our position, as we stated in the brief, that under the Covenant Not to Compete Act, it has preemptive and exclusive language in there where the only avenue for recovery, the criteria for enforcement of the covenant, and then the exclusivity for the remedies and the procedures are to be looked for or to be governed by the Act.
Counsel, was Section 15 of the Business and Commerce Code part of your answer? Did you file that as a preemption, as an affirmative defense?
No.
Was it part of your motion for summary judgment?
Well, I was responding. They moved for summary judgment. I did.
Okay.
It wasn't part of my response until the court, we asked permission after the court had the oral hearing, asked permission to submit additional authorities to the court, which I did, and that is at that point that I raised the issue of presumption.
And we don't have a transcript of that hearing before us.
I don't.
Well, and didn't that briefing that the court asked you to provide have to do with talking about a mandatory venue case? I can't recall the name of the case, but it didn't have to do with preemption from what...
That is correct.
So what the court gave you permission to do was to respond on a point related to mandatory venue.
But he asked for... I asked for time for additional response. I don't know if it was that particular, if I was just... But they did raise another case. I asked for time for additional response, and it is correct that at that point, in a letter to the court, I raised this issue of preemption.
We don't have any record that you had permission from the court to do it in that way.
None, I don't believe, other than the fact that that's what...
So how can we reach this issue under Rule 166A that required the issue to be joined in your response to the summary judgment motion?
But I think the issue
or
is...
Or with the permission of the court at a later point in time.
But I think the issue can be joined if the court grants you permission and you do respond to the court and raise any issues where it's an issue of law, similar to the Holland case, really can't be... It's not something that can be waived at that point. So before the court renders a decision...
But where did the court... Where did the court grant permission
The court granted permission for me to respond, and I did.
Where in the record can we see the court granting permission? What piece of paper in the record is there that shows that?
All you have is the... unless we had the hearing, which we don't, in front of you, all you have is the fact that I... in my letter, which I attached, stated that I was responding to the court's request, the court's allowing me to respond to file anything else with the court.
Is the letter in the record?
It was attached to one of my briefs.
Let me ask you this on the preemption issue. Your argument, as I understand it, is that the particular statute that permits attorney's fees to recover, to be recovered by an employee who defends on a covenant not to compete, is preemptive of any other statute authorizing the recovery of attorney's fees.
Yes, sir.
Now, there's a statute 38001, I guess, which is authorizes attorney's fees to recover in the event you sue on a contract. Seems to me there's some authority out there that indicates that if I simply defend, somebody sues me for breach of contract and I defend and I win, I don't necessarily get my attorney's fees for having defended. I didn't sue on the contract. I'm not suing to enforce the contract. I just said I didn't breach it. And there's some authority out there that says you don't get attorney's fees if you're not suing to enforce that contract. If I'm correct in that, does the statute that authorized recovery of attorney's fees for successfully defending against a claim of breach of contract, which would be the covenant not to compete, that allows attorney's fees, is that necessarily inconsistent with the statute that otherwise allows recovery of attorney's fees if you seek to enforce a contract? You understand my question?
Yes. I just believe that with this preemptive and exclusive language of the statute, it is basically saying every remedy is contained within the statute. It's been my point. In other words, you're not looking to another statute because arguably, certainly, you could recover by bringing suit first, as they did, very shrewdly, I might add, bringing suit under the Declaratory Judgment Act, you can arguably try to, in effect, do harm to the intent or purposes of the Covenant Not to Compete Act. In other words,
does the same preemptive language preclude an employer who sues to enforce one of these covenants from recovering attorney's fees under either Chapter 37 for breach of, for declaratory judgment or under the breach of contract provision? I mean, if it's preemptive, are you saying that employers never sue for breach of contract or declaratory relief and seek to recover their attorney's fees?
Well, I'm not. Nothing to prevent anybody from pleading for anything they want.
Well, but there's a lot of case law out there awarding employers attorney's fees either for breach of contract or under the declaratory judgment statute when they have sued to enforce a covenant not to compete. All those cases wrong?
If this issue, I don't believe this issue has been raised before.
Well, I understand, but I'm just trying to understand the effect of the decision. Are you prepared under this preemption argument for it to be applied uniformly to employers as well, so that there will be no recovery of attorney's fees by employers who sue to recover?
That's exactly right. Unless they make provision for it, unless any provision was made in the statute, what my point is, unless provision is made in the statute, then you don't have any basis for recovering any remedy other than what the statute allows you to do.
How do you account for the language then in the statute that says it's procedures and remedies in an action to enforce a covenant when a declaratory judgment action is not in fact an action to enforce a covenant?
Right. Well, of course it is. I mean, a declaratory judgment action is nothing but other than a procedural remedy to try to get an issue resolved by the court. But there's no meat to the declaratory judgment action. You have to look somewhere else, and obviously you're going to have to look to this statute to determine enforcement.
But an employee does not sue under the declaratory judgment action to enforce the covenant not to compete.
Well, I think, again, that goes to the issue of, you know, what did the legislature intend?
Right, and that's why I'm trying to understand how you would have us deal with that language in the statute, which seems to deal with procedures and remedies in an action to enforce a covenant. And if this is not an action to enforce a covenant, then how are we to agree with your position, and how would we write the opinion to deal with that language?
Well, I think that it can't be construed that restrictively like the Court of Appeals said, and it says it's just in an action to enforce. Well, obviously, the intent of the legislature was to, in response to court's decisions where the legislature had trouble trying to get the covenants not to compete to be enforceable, I think it was clear from what they cited and what this court recognized in the Light case, is that the legislature was trying to say, this is it. You know, we're trying to get these enforced, and this is the preemptive language, and we're going to preempt the common law. They tried to preempt the court here, and everything to try to get some sort of certainty for employers who are trying to enforce covenant not to compete. So I think that it would be, frankly, sort of ludicrous to say, well, simply because you're not seeking to enforce it in declaratory judgment action, then obviously, you know, you can recover your attorney fees. I don't think that is obviously not in accord with the intent of the legislature to try to set forth specifically what employers could rely on and employees in terms of what is and is not enforceable and what can and cannot be recovered.
When I was in the trial bench, a declaratory judgment action would be brought. Typically, I guess, the plaintiff attempting to establish venue for a claim that they know very good and well they're going to be challenged with in the very near future. So they race down. And then, after the lawyers appear in court and we talk about it, we said, I said, well, wait a minute. I know it's a declaratory judgment, but basically, the defendant in this declaratory judgment is going to have to prove their claim that's out there. So I'm going to reverse the order of the parties. And defendant becomes plaintiff becomes defendant, and we move forward. Would the employee then be defending the covenant not to compete? Defending against that and be entitled to attorney's fees, even if they were the nominal plaintiff in the declaratory judgment action?
Well, no, I think you're not entitled to attorney fees, but you are correct in terms of the position. Obviously, what happened in this case was a race to the courthouse. You know, we had sent a letter saying, you know, you cease and desist, quit selling our products and using our customer list and competing against us in this area where we have a covenant not to compete. So to preempt us, in effect, they filed suit, you know, like an hour before we filed suit, and I think very inventively.
But nothing precludes them from doing that. Once someone says you're breaching the contract, you need to stop doing it. Then nothing precludes them under the declaratory. It's not a declaratory judgment action for them going and saying, "Whoa, before I do anything else, I want to make sure I'm okay."
Right. I think it's a very shrewd decision on their part.
It wasn't anything improper under the law.
Oh,
doing that.
No, okay. Not at all. I'm just, I just wish I'd beat them to it.
But not really, because then you don't know attorneys to be. Right.
Well, if I had filed, again, just the declaratory judgment action is just to try to decide, obviously, this issue, and we have to look somewhere else for the construction, like I've said. So you're going to have to look at the statute. So you're going to resolve this, even though he's filed a declaratory judgment action. It's not the meat of the. We're going to have to decide this issue under the Act.
But you admit. In a normal suit where there are no attorney's fees, if someone brings a normal type of cause of action for which there's no attorney's fees, if one brings a declaratory judgment action, the courts have allowed attorney's fees in the past.
Right, but not in a tort case. In other words, you can't, if you ran a stop sign, I think if you filed a declaratory judgment action saying they owe me $1 million because they ran a stop sign, I assume the courts at that point would say.
Is that discretionary with the judge?
I hope not. I hope you can't. I hope you can't so beat the law down, the American rule, that you can't recover attorney fees unless specifically provided with this sort of this, admittedly, tremendously broad declaratory judgment action, which has been trying to be used here, you know, in my opinion, obviously, against the will of the legislature.
Mr. Whiteside, if this case, if you prevail in this case and it is returned to the trial court, the plaintiff be entitled under Section 15.51C to seek recovery of their attorney's fees?
I don't believe so. I believe they had to prove that.
Well, I understand they'd have to prove it. But
I mean, they had to prove it then.
Assuming that they could prove the requirements in terms of your client overreaching, I guess, just to summarize what proof is required, then the court may award the promisor the costs, including reasonable attorney's fees, actually and reasonably incurred by the promisor in defending the action to enforce the covenant.
That's correct.
In this declaratory judgment action, would he be allowed, if he met the proof requirements, would he be allowed to recover his attorney's fees even though he was the plaintiff in the declaratory judgment action?
Yes.
So you would still say in that instance he's defending an action to enforce the covenant even
right.
though he's a plaintiff in a declaratory judgment.
Right.
Okay.
You have to look at
who has the burden of proof under the statute?
I have the burden of proof.
So even though he is the plaintiff, the statute gives you the burden.
But again, he's just nominally the plaintiff. The declaratory judgment action, you know, who is the plaintiff? Really, all they're trying to do is say, court, decide this issue for us.
My point is that once the case was put in court under this statute, no matter who brought it first, even though it was a declaratory judgment action, as soon as it was before the judge, then he became the party that had to defend the action. You became the party that had to enforce the covenant.
Yes, right.
Under the statute, that's what the statute says, under 15.51b.
Yes, and then he would have to, again, going back to the attorney fees, he'd have to show that this restriction was unreasonable. It was an action for a case of personal services. It was unreasonable, and that we knew it was unreasonable before he can recover his attorney fees, which makes sense. But not just recover attorney fees because you're the prevailing party. And, of course, in this case, we just simply, after we lost the temporary injunction, you know, we gave up.
Any questions?
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument in response.
May it please the court. Mr. Charles Walls will present argument for respondent.
Justices, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to speak to you. I think the court is very much on track with what I would like to point out to the court this morning and ask the court to consider the broader implications of what it is that Gage Van Horn is asking this court to do today. I would point out that this case is somewhat unique. There was a race to the courthouse, however, it was a race to the same courthouse. There was a declaratory judgment action, however, it was on both sides. Both parties asked for declaratory relief. The way it actually shook out at trial was that both parties had asked for a declaration, just a different declaration.
And did your client seek a reformation or modification of the covenant at all?
I believe that wasn't specifically requested, although I will point out that Gage Van Horn did seek only to enforce a portion of the covenant. It had a broader geographical reference than what they actually intended or what they actually sought to enforce. So there was really never a question as to reformation of the contract, just was it valid. And it was a classic case of a contract signed almost two decades before by a young man right out of college. He had spent the next almost 20 years working for a company. As the facts were presented, we contended, and the court agreed, that he was, in essence, forced out, forced to resign, and that contract, which was an at-will contract, no guarantee of employment, was simply not an otherwise enforceable contract on which a valid covenant not to compete could hang. Now, counsel has argued, and this court has pointed out, that the language of Chapter 15 is somewhat unique. I mean, in one sentence in Section 15.52, the legislature stated that certain criteria and certain procedures for enforcement of covenant are exclusive and preemptive. It twice used the phrase, as this court has pointed out on several occasions here this morning, in an action to enforce. That language included twice in one sentence to qualify and limit the scope of that provision. If you take that language out of that provision, it still reads fine. And in fact, if the legislature had intended what Mr. Whiteside has argued here today, that it was a total preemption of everything having to do with covenants not to compete, certainly the legislature could have done a much better job of drafting by just simply taking those two limiting phrases out. Those two phrases, repeated twice in one sentence, have to be given meaning.
But does it matter if the action to enforce is originally filed or is a counterclaim? As long as the case itself, by original petition or counterclaim, involves an attempt to enforce, why is that a distinction with a difference?
Well, I'm not sure that there is a distinction except to the fact that the legislature was concerned with their perceived inability to get the courts to recognize criteria under which these agreements could be enforced. They were concerned. I don't believe there was a concern on the legislature's part that there is law out there that allows an employee to defend and to ask the court to strike down these agreements. That was very obvious to the legislature, that law existed. Their concern was aimed at setting up a set of rules and a statute which would ensure and guarantee that employers could also enforce these contracts. So I think procedurally, it really, I don't believe it makes a difference as to how the parties are necessarily aligned. One party is obviously seeking to enforce the contract and seeking extraordinary remedies such as injunctive relief.
So which party here is seeking to enforce?
Gage Van Horn.
Okay.
Sought to enforce it.
Right, and so you're defending an action to enforce.
Exactly. My position was we wanted, because we had been threatened with a lawsuit based on a contract which we felt was clearly invalid and unenforceable, Mr. Tatum was put to a choice. Do I seek declaratory relief before I go out and open my business and take the risk that at some point down the road I'm going to be enjoined? Or do I go to the courthouse now and seek that declaration in advance?
Would you be making the same argument had you not gotten to the courthouse first?
I think so. I don't think it would have mattered. I mean, we both asked for declaratory relief. Ultimately, I wanted a declaration that this was an invalid contract. I didn't want this contract enforced. I think it's interesting.
But if they got to the courthouse first and filed a declaratory judgment action, I guess they didn't file a breach of contract action because your client had not yet begun his business.
That's correct.
It was a declaratory judgment action and a request for injunctive relief to stop him from starting the business.
That is correct.
Why, if they'd gotten to the courthouse first and filed their DEC action and sought injunctive relief, at least as to the injunctive relief, why wouldn't you be defending against an action to enforce a covenant within the meaning of the statute?
I was defending, but I'm not sure the statute gets to defense. I mean, if you look to 1551, and let's just take a moment because I think this is very important. The court will notice in subparagraph A of 1551 that the remedies that the legislature allows are solely for the promisee. There is no mention of remedies for the promisor. None. There is no mention of declaratory relief. Now, if you couple that with, look at section C of 1551. The first phrase in that long section that is, in essence, two very long sentences, the first section says, if you find that the contract is, or the covenant is part of an otherwise enforceable agreement. So for subsection C to apply, the court has to first find that we have a valid contract. If you have a valid contract, then you get down to the remedies that set out in 1551C, including attorney's fees for the promisor, my client, only if the promisee seeks to enforce that otherwise valid contract beyond its reasonable limits or beyond its reasonable terms. In reality, if you have a situation such as the one that exists here today, we had a contract that was not otherwise enforceable. My client never gets a remedy. Under the argument that has been put forth here today, and under the plain reading of 1551C, my client would have no remedy, period. None. Under Chapter 51.
Are you saying then that if we interpret, if I understand this correctly, if we interpret the clause the way that Mr. Whiteside would have us do it, that even filing a declaratory judgment action in the first place would not be an option because that would be a procedure?
Absolutely. And I think it's important to note that even though we're talking here about attorney's fees under Section 3709 of the Declaratory Judgment Act, we're not talking about preemption of just a piece of the Declaratory Judgment Act. You're talking about preemption of the entire act. Now,
so let me make sure I understand. If there's no legally enforceable covenant not to compete, and the promisee elects not to bring a suit over it, if their argument prevails, the promisor would never have any vehicle to bring the issue to court.
That's correct. Other than simply going and opening his business and just waiting for the lawsuit to get served. I mean, that's his only option. And then he can come in and defend that it's not a valid contract. But he has no vehicle by which he can
and
get to
court. And that's because the statute speaks in terms of remedies for the promisee.
That's correct. Now, if in 1552 you give meaning to the limiting phrases in an action to enforce, you start to see a picture here of not two provisions of two different codes that conflict, but actually pieces of a puzzle that fit together and actually complement each other. If you assume that the legislature knew that the promisor always had the option to go get declaratory relief and remedies under the Declaratory Judgment Act. And now we have created a statutory scheme whereby we have guaranteed that the promisee also has remedies available, damages, injunctive relief. Then you see us, you see two statutes that are interwoven, not conflicting, but complementing each other.
Well, but what if you do have an action to enforce, as we have here? That has been done. And it's established in the action to enforce that you do have an otherwise enforceable agreement. It is ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement. Then doesn't subsection C preempt you on the attorney's fee piece?
Well, I think that, again, only applies if you have a situation where the court has found that it's an otherwise enforceable contract.
Then, okay, if that's the case, then you would agree 1551C trumps the Declaratory Judgment Act.
Right, I would agree.
If you prove those pieces.
I would agree, because I think where the legislature was going was, you know, it's not necessarily win or lose. I mean, if you have a situation where the agreement is clearly unenforceable because it's totally at will and it's not an otherwise enforceable agreement, so we have remedies under the Declaratory Judgment Act for the promisor in that situation. Then the other situation where it is part of an otherwise valid contract, court says, you know, looks at the facts and determines that it is valid. Sometimes, even in that scenario, certain employers and through their counsel decide to enforce an agreement beyond its reasonable scope. Now, I'll compliment Mr. Whiteside and Gabe Van Horn because they didn't seek to do that. They had an opportunity to do that. I mean, they had a contract which had a very broad territorial definition, and they sought only to enforce it within a small 5-county area that was actually only involved. But let's assume for a minute that they hadn't made that decision and they had sought to enforce the contract in its entire geographical region. Then a court could find that even though it is a valid contract and even though I'm going to enforce it to some degree, I believe the employer was a little out of line here in seeking to enforce it to its full extent. And so under those circumstances, the promisor can still get some award of attorney's fees for defending and basically getting the court to back off of the full enforcement.
Now, well, and even that's difficult, isn't it? Because you have to show that the promisor, you have to establish that the promisee knew at the time the agreement was executed. Mm-hmm. And that's a difficult burden.
It could be. It sure could be. Now, we never really faced that question. You know, the transcript indicates that the parties had already determined that they were only going to seek enforcement within a certain geographical area. But I think the statute was written in such a way as to deal with the eventuality that you could have a valid agreement that an employer is seeking to enforce in an unreasonable manner and create an opportunity, even if, you know, you win and you lose, I guess, one of those kind of deals. Yes?
Let me ask you a question on your waiver argument. Mm-hmm. Isn't it true that the court invited further briefing on the issue of the applicability of the covenant not to be asked?
I believe that the court invited further briefing of the issues that were presented to it at the hearing. Preemption was not presented to the court at the hearing.
Were attorney's fees an issue here?
Yes. In fact, that was really the sole issue.
So further briefing on attorney's fees means further briefing?
If you took a broad reading of that. But as Mr. Whiteside pointed out, Gage Van Horn was not at that point aggressively seeking to enforce the covenant any longer, and had basically, they hadn't consented to summary judgment in our favor, but had also not contested anything other than the award of attorney's fees. And so the court invited further briefing, but the preemption argument was never raised until after, in response to that, after the hearing in a letter, basically a letter brief, is raised for the first time. Now, I believe that if you're going to raise such an issue that was not raised before the hearing, that Rule 166A is very clear, that you have to seek permission of the court.
Would you have any obligation whatsoever to get some indication from the court in writing that it did not consider preemption as a ground these days?
From a litigation standpoint, and as a zealous advocate to my client, my fear would be that I would be inviting the court to rule on it when it really hadn't. I don't think that's my burden. to ask the court to rule on that motion, or to basically make the motion and get permission. I just don't believe that's my place or my requirement to do so. Nothing further. I have said all I had to say. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Whiteside, how do you address the argument that, because opposing counsel has constructed a scheme that appears fairly workable, if you as the employer can prove that it is the agreement, the covenant is ancillary to an otherwise enforceable contract and is enforceable for that reason, you can rely on this statute. In other words, if you try to enforce it beyond its scope, I think counsels agree that C would preempt their right to recover attorney's fees. But if you are unable to prove that it's a valid covenant, ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement, then the promisor is out of luck under your construction, cannot bring a declaratory judgment act claim. How do you deal with that?
Well, that's correct. In other words, it provides for my remedy and his. I don't get attorney fees under A. It talks about, you know, damages, injunctive relief. It prescribes what I can and cannot get.
I'm envisioning a situation where his client sues for declaratory judgment that this is not an enforceable agreement, and the court finds it's not an enforceable agreement. Your construction with this preemption is that they are now no longer entitled, they cannot get attorney's fees for having gotten that declaration.
Well, he can still try to get attorney fees under the provision here as the promisor. If he shows that, you know, it was overbroad, that was the only provision.
No. But the way I understand he's reading the statutory scheme is, under B, you have the burden to show that it's an enforceable covenant.
Right.
Maybe too broad, but just in the first instance, it's enforceable.
Right.
Because properly ancillary.
Right.
If you can't show that, then under your construction that this entire statute preempts declaratory judgment, then he might be able to knock out your covenant.
But he doesn't get his
attorney's fees. But he gets attorney's
fees. Right, that's right.
And where is that?
I mean, it's by exclusion. It says it provides the only remedy here about when he can get attorney fees.
I think his statutory construct has some appeal because If you do limited preemption just under C, then once you've established that your covenant is good, but you're just seeking to enforce it too broadly, he can get attorney's fees under C, and I think he acknowledged does preempt the attorney's fee issue if you make that initial showing. Then attorney's fees are awarded to the extent you've sought to enforce too broadly.
Right. But not just from defending the case. In other words, I'm just saying...
But C requires to invoke C, the court has to have found the covenant to be ancillary to the agreement. If you don't have that finding, you never get into C.
Right. So I'm just saying there's not a remedy.
For example, in this instance, since the covenant was not found to be valid, C's never invoked. You never go any further.
Right. Of course, we really didn't get to the, you know, finding the validity of this particular covenant. It went up on a temporary injunction. They decided, Eastern Court of Appeals decided it wasn't enforceable.
But also, would your reading of the preemption clause in 15.52 preclude him from even seeking a declaratory judgment in the first clause, since it says it's preclusive as to procedures and remedies? So he can't even go to the courthouse in the first place once he gets the letter saying...
I think you can try to seek it, and then it's my...
Well, but it says procedures and remedies. Why isn't that a procedure?
It is a procedure. It didn't say, you know, you can't file suit. It doesn't specify what kind of suit is to be filed.
Well, but you're saying it has very, very broad preemptive language. And if it has the kind of broad preemptive language that you say it does, which means it doesn't really matter how the parties are postured, then it would seem to preclude the promisor from even seeking a declaratory judgment in the first place, because it says that the procedures and remedies in action to defend are exclusive.
Right. Well, it doesn't really provide those procedures. I mean, just like the court did in Light, the court said it really didn't provide the standards for what's ancillary. So this court provided the, filled in the gap. But I don't think there's a gap to fill in on.
Well, how are we going to, I don't understand how we fill in that gap if we give the preemption clause very broad preclusive effect. How can, if you're going to sweep it broadly, how do you avoid sweeping everything out the door, including the ability of the promisee to seek declaratory relief when he's under threat of action that he would like to avoid and wants to know what his legal rights are before he proceeds?
Well, I think he can file it, then it's up to the, you know, the defendant could come in there. If he joins issue, then it's his burden to try to establish it. So, in effect, you're going to have the resolution.
But I'm not sure, if we give the broad effect that you're talking about, how do we carve out the Declaratory Judgment Act in the first place from the terms, procedures, and remedies?
Well, it doesn't speak to that, you know, one way or the other. I think what I'm saying is on the remedy action, it does preclude a remedy that the Declaratory Judgment Action provides. That is the attorney fees. That's what I'm saying. Unless it's in here, you can't recover attorney fees. Now, I don't think they specifically...
Why would the legislature afford the promissory relief for a valid covenant that's just too broad, but not afford any relief for an invalid covenant?
Well, why should I mean, it can decide whether to provide relief or not. Again, it's the American rule. The only relief that he would seek, you know, if he wins or it's he's not being forced anywhere, he's not, you know, out any money. But the legislature can decide we're going to allow a remedy in a particular situation, and they haven't provided a remedy.
My question to you is, under your construct, if the agreement is valid but just simply overly broad, they can get attorney's fees to the extent it's overbroad. Why would the legislature afford that, but then say, if you've drafted a wholly unenforceable agreement, we're not going to give you any attorney's fees?
I think, as I'm sure you've seen legislative actions before, they perhaps don't think of every particular thing that can happen.
So you can't think of any reason why they would, they just did.
Excuse me?
You can't think of any reason why they would, they just did.
No, I just think they were, again, they've been rebuffed on most issues. They've tried to, you know, make these things enforceable, and they did the best job they could with what they had to try to be specific on this, in this act. And I think they were certainly specific about their decision to say, this is exclusive and preempts. And I think that's the issue that I think... Because if you give them the ability to file this declaratory judgment action and then to recover the attorney fees, then you've just, you know, you've turned the car over.
Well, my understanding, though, is that's not the position they've taken. You only get attorney's fees if it's proven that the covenant is valid and they've acknowledged that in that instance, 1551C would preempt the Declaratory Judgment Act.
Well, their position is we filed suit so they could get the attorney fees. In other words, we've for an employer to run the risk that they're concerned that if they try to enforce the covenant not to compete or valid or whatever, they could still run the risk of the Declaratory Judgment Act having to pay their attorney fees. So I think the legislature was trying to provide some sort of support for the employers who are drafting these agreements.
So it'll protect an employer who's overbroad, but not one who's overreaching.
Well, it doesn't punish him, but it doesn't reward them either, except when they are clearly overreaching and they knew they were overreaching, then you get your attorney fees. So that's the thing the legislature did to tell employers, you know, don't try to do this or you will pay the employee for trying to make this kind of unreasonable statute that you knew was unreasonable, try to enforce it against them.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument for the first clause.
All right.